Welcome to the Rennie Podcast, where we talk about the real estate market and the people connected by it. Our goal is to empower you to make informed decisions and provide context for the real estate world around you. We hope that with every episode, you will become a little more knowledgeable and a lot more curious.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ryan Berlin, Rennie's Senior Economist and Vice President of Intelligence. And I'm here with Ryan Wise, Rennie's Market Intelligence Manager and Lead Analyst with our Intelligence Division. We are joined today by Brett Jones, Rennie Advisor Extraordinaire. Welcome, Brett. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Ryan and Ryan.
In today's episode, we'll spend some time discussing Victoria's housing market, what makes it tick, where things stand 2 months into the year. And then we'll share some thoughts on a few new housing policy announcements that were recently made by the provincial government. One of them was on flipping homes, and a couple of them were related to changes in the application of the dreaded property transfer tax. Gentlemen, how are you guys doing?
Not too bad. How about you?
Absolutely fantastic. Thrilled to be here on this lovely rainy day.
And you flew Indeed. In to be with us today from Victoria.
I did. It was a bit of a bumpy ride, kind of like real estate in 2024.
Ooh, good start.
I love that flight.
That means it'll be a smooth ride on the way back, yeah. Right?
That's absolutely guaranteed.
Excellent. Brett, let's start with you. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your real estate origin story?
My real estate origin story. Well, I spent the early part of my adulthood in the clothing business. And when I realized that retail was not for me, the only industry that appealed was real estate. So I got in working as a licensed assistant for a top producing realtor who did project sales. So that was the early start of my career in the early 2000s.
Was that in Victoria?
That was in Victoria, yeah. And I worked for primarily Chard Development, a well-known name around these parts. Mm-hmm. And got out of project side of things about 15 years ago to concentrate on single family and better homes in the more desirable parts of Victoria. Kind of carved out a niche for myself as being the go-to guy for unique and interesting homes.
And so is that mostly in the resale space?
Yeah, 100% resale.
What are you seeing right now? Victoria is not Vancouver.
No.
We spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about the Vancouver market. Mm-hmm. Certainly there's a dynamic between Vancouver and Victoria, but What makes Victoria tick as a market?
You know, there's subtle nuance to that. It's kind of like asking what makes a Canadian different from an American. We look the same, we sound the same, but we're not the same.
It's how we spell.
That's true. And are you out and about? Really, Victoria is a slower place than Vancouver, but it's picked up its pace significantly over the last 5 years. We've seen a rapid urbanization of our city and a cultural shift based on the migratory patterns of Canadians. Mm-hmm. It seems everybody's moving west, and the end of the line is Victoria. So prices high in Vancouver, you want to cash out of the west side, you move to Victoria, you can buy twice as nice a house for half the price. And with that comes a little bit more big city culture, big city thinking, traffic, social issues. And as a lifelong Victorian, it's quite fascinating to watch.
Do you think there's that phrase that people sometimes characterize Victoria with, that it's a city for newlyweds and nearly dead?
Well, it had been most of my life, but it's definitely not that way now. Interestingly, the amount of choice that has come over the last 5 years has been staggering. We have no shortage of restaurant choices now, entertainment options, concerts, even just the ease of which to get out of the city and do something interesting. There's just so much more choice than there's ever been in my whole life. And that just comes with more people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So historically, people thought of the island as a great place to retire. But I think now it's a much wider age range. Would you say there's a lot more younger adults moving to the island that are part of your network?
Absolutely. And particularly with the advent of remote working. You know, if you're remote working in Winnipeg, why would you spend your winter there when right. you can come out to the island and on the same day you can ski, surf, and golf?
Yeah, and for somebody moving to the region, like the drive from downtown to Langford's, what, 20 minutes? Like,
well,
depending on time of day, relative to, you know, Burnaby to Vancouver, North Van to Vancouver.
Even Vancouver to Vancouver. Yeah.
You know, it's all about perspective, because Victorians generally lived by the 15-minute rule. If you had to drive more than 15 minutes, it wasn't worth doing. Well, now you can't really get anywhere for less than 20, 25 minutes. And I have told many of my friends who have moved outside of that driving circle that they're dead to me.
So yeah, I find the capital region, Greater Victoria, to be maybe misunderstood a little bit by people who don't live there. And I think one of the things that stands out to me is the perception of its size. I think a lot of people think Victoria is actually bigger than it is, because in that entire region, there's fewer than 400,000 people. Right, it's about what, 1/6, 1/7 the size of Metro Vancouver.
Absolutely, and that just gives it a completely different vibe. And what works in Vancouver isn't guaranteed to work in Victoria, because it's not like we're less sophisticated, but we're just more resistant to fast pace.
You know what? I was going to transition and Rye ask you a couple of questions, but one question for you, something that's unique about that region and the city, is the presence of the provincial government and employment in the public sector, which I think is around a quarter of all jobs.
Yes.
What dynamic does that introduce into the housing market, if any, whether it's on the for sale side or maybe the rental side, that's different from other markets?
Well, you know, Victoria is a bit of a paradox, because you do have the government being the major employer, and secondly would be tourism, and then thirdly would be military. And those generally aren't the highest of paying jobs, yet our average cost of housing is significantly high. It's amongst the highest in the nation. So you wonder, how does this work? How does this make sense? Remote working, people bringing their money from other centers, young retirees. In the 2000s and the 2010s, it was Albertans and people from Saskatchewan moving. And now it's really all over the country coming. I had a building inspector tell me, you know, everybody just seems to come here with a suitcase of money. And it does feel a bit like that. But that's kind of what makes the city work and for lack of a better expression, props up those prices. How does this make sense when the average income isn't actually that high in Victoria? It's money coming in from other centers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm, you know, my guess is that over the next 10 to 20 years, as we look at the aging baby boomers making decisions about where they're going to live, downsizing, cashing out on their home that they maybe bought 20 to 40 years ago for a basket of raspberries. And we know in Vancouver, or in Metro Vancouver, two out of five homeowners have no mortgage. So, you know, to the extent that Victoria is so much smaller than Vancouver. It doesn't take a lot of people moving from Vancouver to Victoria with some cash in that briefcase to make an impact on that market.
It's true. You know, if you get 5,000 new residents in a year, it doesn't sound like much, but those 5,000 residents make a huge impact, because we're also geographically small. We're on the south tip of an island surrounded by mountain.
Right.
So there's only so much space that we can fill. And there's only so much infrastructure that can expand in so many ways. So 5,000 people means 4,000 cars, means a lot more traffic.
Yeah, great point.
Absolutely.
You just whet our appetite there with a couple of data points.
Yeah, did I hear numbers?
Yes. Oh, okay, Ryan's awake. Ryan.
What do you got there, numbers?
Eyeing you up and down. Wise, looking at that market as we kick off, we're two months into 2024, amazingly. I mean, it's as we record this, we're in almost the middle of March. What are you seeing in the data?
Yeah, so I like what you said, Brett, about some of the similarities and some of the nuance between Victoria and Vancouver's markets. They're closely related markets that follow some similar trends and then have some key differences. And I think what we're seeing so far in 2024 is a similar sort of start to the year in both Victoria and Vancouver. So we see market that's really sort of just starting to gain some momentum after a really, really sluggish 2023. And so the pace of sales is kind of picking up. There's a bit of seasonality at play, but there's also sort of, I would say, some optimism about potential interest rate decreases and some opportunities for buyers. So February home sales were over 400 in the region for the first time since September. So for context, that's around the same as last February, about 25% less than is typical. So you typically see in a February about 550, 560 home sales. So we're not quite sort of hitting back to that average level, but the pace of sales is picking up, the pace of new listings is picking up, inventory is growing and above average, so there's a bit more sort of activity in the market. And I think really it's sort of, whether it's Vancouver, it's Victoria, we're seeing more people kind of get out there and have started sort of participating a little bit more than they did in the latter half of 2023.
And no doubt, as is the case in Vancouver, the impending interest rate cuts that everybody is expecting sooner than later, very likely driving the increased activity, whether it's more viewings or it's actually translating to more listings and more sales. The Bank of Canada did just make a rate announcement, Rye, last week. What came out of that?
So as expected, not a lot. So they were expected to hold their policy rate, and they did. And I think always we get excited, or I do at least, I won't lump you guys in with me, to parse the language of their press release and to pick out those nuggets.
We like doing that. You like that, right, Brett?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Of course, all we've talked about for the last couple of years is interest rates. I really don't think an interest rate cut is actually going to supercharge the market in any way, shape, or form. They need to come down a lot for that to happen. But what it does is it allows people to just get on with life again. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're at now. People are just ready to stop talking about all the bad and let's just get on with it.
I tend to agree. I know there's a concern on the part of the Bank of Canada and others that a whiff of an interest rate cut, even a quarter point, is going to send everyone back out into the market. And money's still relatively expensive. And so
prices are still relatively high.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, housing is more unaffordable. And you look at the cost of it, what it costs to maintain a mortgage, to own a home.
There are a number of buyers that are waiting for a bit more sort of certainty that rates are going to keep coming down. And every single month where they start to come down, I think we'll see a few more buyers come in, a few more buyers come in. We talked last month that our forecast for this year is below average sales, but 20 to 25% more sales than last year. And I still think that's what we're talking about here, is a bit more activity, but nowhere near what we were seeing in prior years.
I just have to look at the whole trajectory of my 23 years selling real estate that people still talk about 1982.
Right.
And people aren't going to forget.
Tell us about that. Well, I was a child. I don't recall it so well.
I remember it had an incredible impact on my life. I was 12 in 1982, so you do the math, I'm old. But at that time, it changed everything. My parents were pretty successful. We had a really comfy life, and then it was a struggle for 10 years after that.
Because rates rose to what? Mortgage rates, 20%?
20%.
Yeah.
Now, different pricing structures, but that was hard. That was really hard. And as a 12-year-old, I wasn't smart and sophisticated, but I knew that when I wasn't getting a new pair of soccer boots for soccer season, something had changed.
So this is our generation's 1982.
It is. And it's going to have an impact for 20 years. We'll be talking about this 20 years from now, telling our kids and grandkids, hey, things aren't as good as you think.
Yeah. And we talk about this as, you know, once in a generation inflation, once in a generation interest rates. It is sort of a 40-year phenomenon, yep. But that's what we're facing. If I could pivot back to that Bank of Canada press release that I'm so excited to talk about for a sec.
Okay.
Riveting. Thank you. There's a few quotes I'd like to pull because I think they're really telling and sort of new. Whereas they kind of just held rates, or they didn't just kind of, they did. There's new language that I think is important. So one is, I'll quote, overall the data point to an economy in modest excess supply. So that says that now there's more supply than demand, that inflation is falling to a point where they're almost ready to start cutting rates. And I think that's actually a really telling statement. They're almost ready. They're waiting for a few more things to happen, which they get into later. They're looking at 3-month moving averages of core measures. So core measures being CPI, trim, common, and median, which are sort of measures of inflation that strip out some of the more volatile elements. And all of that is to say that they've seen almost enough. It's like that guy who calls elections who says, I've seen enough. They've seen almost enough. And so we are one or two meetings away from that first small rate cut.
Next meeting being April 10th.
Mm-hmm.
And following that, I believe they meet in June.
Yeah. And so between recording of this podcast and the April 10th announcement is a very important CPI data release. And I think we'll have a rundown of that. And we'll say based on that release and based on their language from last week, that we'll kind of have a good sense for whether they will or won't cut in April.
Fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it's coming. It's a matter of when, not if. And certainly the latest jobs data as well, sort of a little misleading at the headline level. We did add jobs, but we also added a lot of people. Our unemployment rate actually went up again last
month.
That's
really been a common theme for the last, call it, year of job growth not keeping up with population growth. So it's a weakening labor market even as more jobs are being created.
So some interesting data and commentary on the market, on Victoria to start this year. Wanted to pivot into a conversation about policy, housing policy. There was a lot of focus on it at the end of 2023 because there was a slew of measures announced primarily at the provincial level aimed at mostly increasing housing supply throughout the province. But we had three announcements, well, sort of two announcements made in the last few weeks. The one that's getting the most attention is this flipping tax that the province has announced. Essentially, the flipping tax is a 20% levy on the net gain in the value of properties that sell within a year of having been originally purchased. And then that tapers down to no tax at the 2-year mark.
Yeah, so like a sliding scale between 1 and 2 years.
There are exemptions for certain situations like divorce, people moving for a job. So not everybody gets caught up in this. And notably too, there were questions coming out of it initially about pre-sale, like how does this impact the new home market? And what the government has said is that the clock starts ticking, so to speak, when you sign that pre-sale contract. So even before the home is delivered, you sign your contract. And once you've held that contract for 2 years, even if you haven't taken possession of the home, you're outside of that range where the flipping tax would apply. Mm-hmm. So the clock doesn't reset once you actually have your name on title. So that's important to know. But listen, I mean, the flipping tax is aimed at a very small segment of the market.
It is, and it's not actually going to increase any supply at all. In fact, I think it's going to decrease it.
And you're not the only one who thinks that.
Tell us why you think that.
I think that it's going to slow down people from listing and even purchasing a property to rehabilitate and bring up to a proper standard for habitation. So instead of buying a house that really needs work and putting the money into it and maybe creating another suite in it for another house in that, you're going to sit on it for 2 years instead of one. And that's just going to slow things down. And this whole policy of increasing supply through taxation, it's too slow. It's not going to happen fast enough.
And we're still addressing the symptom and not the underlying cause. So those small group of speculators are really only operating in an overheated market. Real estate has very high transaction costs. And so to buy and sell a home and just to flip it in, you know, 3 months, 6 months, you have to be achieving a massive windfall in order to cover your costs, everything else. And that only happens when the prices are going up at a runaway pace.
Let's pivot over to the other policy announcements, not getting nearly as much attention, but I think Wise, you can provide some numerical context here. Changes to the application of the property transfer tax.
Yeah, so there's a few exemptions. I think a lot of people are familiar with the first-time homebuyer exemption of the property transfer tax. So that was capped at $500,000 purchases, and it had been that way since 2017. And a lot of people have rightfully pointed out that in BC's largest markets, there are very few homes available for under $500,000. So most first-time buyers simply couldn't qualify. So they've increased that exemption to $830,000. So like a, call it two-thirds increase. Since 2017, if you, depending on which metrics you use, values have increased, you know, from anywhere from 35 to 65%, depending on, again, you know, the home type, et cetera. So really, they're just sort of making up for that lift in values from 2017 to today. So it's not really a huge increase in the exemption. It's just sort of bringing it back to what it was in 2017. So I think that's probably a positive thing if we want to encourage first-time buyers. And we just looked at the first-time buyer data for the upcoming Rennie landscape, which will be out next month. And first time, the share of first-time buyer purchases have basically plummeted in the last 5 years. So pre-pandemic, it was pretty stable at about 12% of purchases in the province. It's less than half that today. First-time buyers are really having a hard time getting their foot in the door.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to have that exemption, you can argue, should we have it, should we not? But if you're going to have it, it should have some teeth. Yeah. So it seems like a very reasonable change to make. And just to remind listeners too, the property transfer tax applies to the purchase of a property, the cost is incurred by the buyer, and it's equal to 1% on the first $200,000 and 2% on the balance of the purchase price. And so this does, the exemption for first-time homebuyers provides some relief because it's not something you can roll into your mortgage either. So you have to have that extra cash to be able to pay that when you purchase. But then there was another, a new PTT exemption. That
was introduced. So an exemption for new homes up to, I believe, $1.1 million, which is, you know, the average, the data say that the average new home price is around $800,000. In Metro Vancouver. Right. So the average new home, again, this would be mostly condos, but the average new home would qualify for this exemption as well for principal residence.
Now, is this likely, Brett, for you to impact your world? I mean, I imagine you're not working with a lot of first-time home buyers given the segment.
Well, I'm old enough now that I'm working with the children of my long-serving clients. So I actually do work with quite a number of first-time buyers. But of course, what we're seeing with first-time buyers breaking into the market in centers like Victoria and Vancouver, they're getting help from family.
Yeah.
So to break in on your own as a single income earner, it's pretty tough in the bigger centers. And even just to break into the cheapest condo in Victoria that isn't going to special assessment you to death is going to be $400,000.
Right. Right.
So it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll see then how the changes to the PTT structure impacts the market. And hopefully it does make it a little bit easier for a segment of buyers that definitely have been finding it tough over the past couple of years to get in. Okay. Moving on here, each month, part of this podcast, we are looking at headlines about the real estate market, providing our take on what's actually happening. An interesting one from last week, Rye.
So there was a data release from Equifax on the number of mortgage delinquencies in Canada, and all the major media outlets picked it up. And there was a whole bunch of really scary headlines about the rate of increase for mortgage delinquencies. And it sounded really bad, but if you got to the bottom of the article, you saw that the number's actually incredibly low. So we look at a different source that tracks mortgage arrears, but it's kind of the same data set, but we can get the whole one. So mortgage delinquencies in Canada have risen to 0.18%. So not 18%, not 1.8%, but 0.18%. So 18 out of every 10,000 mortgages are behind on payments. And yes, it has risen, but it's still incredibly low.
And it rose by how much?
I think the article was like 162% or something. It ended up being like 5 out of every 10,000, the rate of increase.
It's still, and this is the rate, the arrears rate, as they call it, is still below the pre-pandemic level. Is that right?
Yeah. So pre-pandemic, it sort of oscillated somewhere between 0.2 and 0.3% in kind of that 2019, 2018 period.
I think it's pretty easy to just say things are never as bad as they seem.
That's right.
I mean, they're never as good as they seem.
Yeah.
There's not much of a story there. I mean, certainly the duration of this trend, if it is a trend towards increasing delinquencies, is something to watch.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't surprise me if it did continue to go up, given the gap, the delta in mortgage rates from when you initiated or previously renewed to when you're renewing now.
But we've talked before about how most renewers are renewing at rates similar to what they had previously been stress tested to. So most renewers are by and large facing payments that are much higher than they were paying, but still in the neighborhood of what they can afford.
Okay, finally, listener questions. Our question this month is from Jim in West Vancouver.
Ryan and Ryan, this is Jim calling from West Van. I love the pod, been listening to it for about a year now. I'm trying to work out how real estate should fit into my investment portfolio, or at least to understand how real estate trends will influence my portfolio. I appreciate the broad view you take and your focus on macro trends. So much of what I come across is regional and I think short-sighted or sensationalist. So guys, my question is this. What does your media diet consist of? What are the top three sources you look to for information on real estate and the forces that influence the market? Thanks, and keep doing what you're doing.
Well, appreciate the kind words, Jim. So that's a great question.
Yeah.
An interesting way to put it as well. Right. Where would you start? So what does your media diet consist of?
So
where do you get your data?
I think for media specifically, I look to a lot of sources. Again, I find it quite sensationalist. We just talked about that delinquency story. And so what I find is if I see a sensationalist headline, but it's a topic that I'm interested in, I read through and then I go and find like three or four more sources on it. So I'll look at all the major Canadian outlets. I look at some of the national ones, some of the local ones, and I try to get as many sources as possible to sort of cut through that noise. And I think the more interesting part is the second part, some of the sources that inform us on the economy and how it relates to housing. And I would start with StatsCan. They have a wonderful daily email that a lot of people probably don't want to read, but I love it. It's called The Daily. It's all their data sources, but also all their write-ups on it. They're not sensationalist. They don't have a horse in the race. And so when the jobs data come out, it's not doom and gloom. It's
you know, descriptive.
This is what happened. You know, here's the trends that you need to know about. Same thing with inflation. And I really think it cuts through a lot of that noise. So I would say that's an important one. We also look to CMHC a bunch. So those are a couple that I think are really, really valuable sources that are more agnostic to, you know, creating a narrative and just want to kind of tell you what is happening or what you need to know.
Yeah, I agree. And BCREA, Brendan Ogmanson and his team produces a lot of wonderful commentary. It's balanced. It's evidence-based when it comes to the potential impact of new policies that are announced here in the province or trends that we're seeing in the marketplace. They're frequently published, easy to consume, and produced by really smart people. So I think that's also a really great source for folks.
Point.
Press releases from your local real estate boards are also very beneficial, although one could argue maybe they're skewed in the favor of realtors, but there's a lot of good information there. And if you follow any of them, they link to many of the places that you just talked about. So that's a good central source to find everything.
Fantastic. Okay, Brett, Thanks so much for joining us today. Really enjoyed the conversation. It was pretty wide ranging. Learned some things about Victoria. Before we go, if listeners wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Oh, well, thanks again for having me, Ryan. And Ryan, easy to find at brettjones.ca. And my email is bjones@rennie.com. Pretty simple.
Nice. Easy.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us on the Rennie podcast. If you'd like to learn more, all resources mentioned in the episode can be found at rennie.com/intelligence. To be the first to receive this information, register for intelligence updates.